Hi, I'm Dr. Stan Steindl. Welcome to Compassion in a T-shirt. Today I'll be speaking with Dr. Kate Lucra, who is a Birmingham, UK-based compassion-focused therapist and supervisor. She specializes in the use of CFT for complex trauma and people experiencing personality and relational difficulties. She works with individuals and groups. And today we'll be discussing a recent publication of hers where she evaluates a compassion-focused psychotherapy group program for people with attachment and relational trauma. She's a wealth of information and common sense, and there's a lot to take away from this conversation. And so I bring you Dr. Kate Lucra. Yes, Kate Lucra. Well, thank you so much for being willing to speak with me anyway. And you're in Birmingham, UK, I think, which I visited in October for the most recent Compassionate Mind Foundation conference. I thoroughly enjoyed your wonderful city. I think it's the birthplace of the Industrial Revolution.
Yeah, I'm not so familiar with that. I know that it's, I would argue it's part of the birthplace of group psychotherapy, which is little known.
Yes. I didn't.
Leon and Fuchs were part of the Northfield experiments in the 1940s during the Second World War. So
right.
Soldiers okay. from the front line were sent back to Northfield, and the Northfield experiment was a way of, well, the military wanted them patched up and ready for war, but Fuchs and Bion at different points were developing group psychotherapy.
Right.
And Bion went on to set up the Tavistock Clinic, and Fuchs went on to set up group analysis. So their stories are absolutely, I could go on about this for ages, fascinating, but
their stories are
fascinating. They were parallel, but they never met, they never spoke about each other, and they never referenced each other. But they were literally at Northfield within months of each other. Really fascinating.
Here was I thinking I was making a hilarious joke about the Industrial Revolution, and you turned it into something quite profound.
Sorry. I know, and that's really unusual because, you know, I usually like a joke, but ruined it. Yeah. Sorry, Stan.
No, we should maybe talk about that other topic another time, because that actually sounds fascinating as well. More so than the, was it James Watt who invented the steam engine in Birmingham? Something like that was what I discovered in my research.
I'm terrible at history, so you got me. I could get my son down here. He's doing history GCSE, I'm sure he could tell us.
Yeah. But we've been friends for several years now. 2016, I worked it out, and it's great to finally get to speak with you on Compassion in a T-shirt. So welcome.
Thank you. It's a real pleasure to be here. Thank you for inviting me, Stan.
Lovely. I was particularly interested in speaking with you today because of your recent publication, Compassion-Focused Group Psychotherapy for Attachment and Relational Trauma, Engaging People with a Diagnosis of Personality Disorder. So it published in the journal Psychology and Psychotherapy Theory, Research and Practice, affectionately known as PAPTRAP. So congratulations there. And I'd like to talk a bit about that. But first of all, would you mind just giving us a little bit of a sense of you or who you are or, you know, where you're coming from, maybe even just your work in the area of CFT or and group work, I guess, too, and personality disorder. So, yeah, give us a feeling for Kate Lucra.
Okay. I was thinking about this morning, actually, because you give me a heads up, which is really helpful, because I had an idea about the steer. I suppose for me, I was never going to be a psychotherapist. I was going to be an actress. But I think, like many actresses or actors, I reached a point very early on when the kind of crashing reality of part-time jobs, constant rejection sort of hit me. And I had to come up with a second plan. But I think I started working with, I suppose, troubling folk back when I was 17, 18. I worked in kids' homes. There's no doubt in my mind I was a troubled kid myself. And when I look around my group therapy room and I think it's not even flip of a coin. It was opportunity that means that I'm sitting in the therapist chair and not in the patient chair. Because I know we talk a lot in CFT, don't we, about the baby swap idea. But actually, for me, I don't think it's even a baby swap. I think it was more about the fact that I was incredibly fortunate to have people who around me when I was really young to help guide me, because without that, I have no doubt that I may well have, well, I think it's quite likely I would have been in the other chair. So I suppose that's my motivation for being, for doing this work, is that there are about four or five people I can think of, Paul Gilbert being one of them, who helped steer me in a different path. I went to Australia when I was 20, and I bought a one-way ticket to Australia, and I was not coming back. Right up until I was almost about to marry the bar manager of the place where I worked. Anyway, that's another story that doesn't need to be on air. But I guess, yeah, that's my motivation. I was going to be an actress. Social work, psychotherapy came much later. But yeah, I think acting and drama and movement has stayed a thread that I've carried with me. It took me a long, many years to realize that I could combine both. I kind of gave up theatre for a while. I was involved in theatre all the way through university, a lot of really dark theatre, actually. Guy called Burkhoff, who kind of, we did sort of Burkhovian style theatre where there was lots of shouting and black stages and people throwing each other to the floor and lots of teenagers taking themselves horribly seriously. We went to Edinburgh Fringe and there was all sorts of things. But then, yeah, so then I trained in social work and was a forensic social worker. Again, I've always worked with people who'd attract a diagnosis of personality disorder. And again, I know that comes from my heart. And then reached a point, I think, where social work didn't, I couldn't do what I wanted to do. As a social worker, there was a limitation to how much I could help people. Driving people around the streets of Leicester, I've said this before in interviews, but, you know, kind of the wanting to be helpful, but actually not having the skills or the capability to be able to help reshape people's lives or their pathways. And so I retrained in psychotherapy and then psychodrama, group analysis. I'm not a group analyst, but I've done 3 years of training in group analysis and CFT. I always tell this story. I was halfway through my CBT training and Paul came to do a workshop on CFT and I was like, oh, damn it, I'm on the wrong course. I want to be on that course. But there wasn't a course then. There wasn't the diploma that we have now. There was, and I'm sure like you, Stan, there were workshops that we, you know, I think might have even met you on some, you know, that we sort of all began to do together and we've developed CFT from there. But I could keep rambling, but that's a potted thing. And then I guess rock climbing, when I'm not working, I like to be rock climbing. And for me, I'm writing a book about CFGP at the moment and constantly like metaphors of, for me, rock climbing and compassion, they have so many overlaps that so many people come to therapy, right? Come saying, I'm going to do this therapy and I'm going to get to the end and it's going to be somehow osmosized something. But there's a lovely quote that says, everyone wants to live on top of the mountain, but all the growth and happiness occur while you're climbing it. And I think that's what psychotherapy is, CFT anyway, and particularly group CFT, is that it's what happens in the group, in the room. It transcends, it transcends unconscious processes. Something, and I don't know, I'm going to say it, something spiritual happens in that room with those people that is absolutely linked to our ancestral history of sitting around the fire, telling stories and making sense. And that's, I think, what happens in group. But I'll stop now because I feel like you'll have to edit that.
No, that's really very sort of helpful and really sort of some profound observations there that you know, like you yourself, you know, you had your own experiences growing up and you know, one thing could or may not have led to another and who knows where we might sort of arrive at as adults and that sort of thing. And in some ways you really recognize various opportunities, some of which were probably just damn luck or something, isn't it? Sometimes, you know, that just are we lucky enough to meet a certain person or to have someone along the way of our journey, and it kind of shapes who we yet become one way or another. And yet you were also, by the sounds of it, quite a compassionate person from those early years as well. You know, working with kids as at 17, I think you said, and you know, sort of doing stuff, always feeling a bit drawn to it. By the sounds of it, like obviously the acting thing was an initial kind of goal in and of itself, but also there you were, you know, compassionate and sort of wanting to be helpful. I can sort of relate to that. I didn't work face to face, but as a sort of a 17, 18-year-old, I was working on Kids Helpline, which is a sort of, you know, just sort of trying to support, you know, kids who are kind of having various difficulties. And so it's sort of, yeah, so the these different threads were always there, really. And then gradually you've kind of merged them all together, the CFT and the compassion, the acting, and that's a big part of CFT as well, isn't it? Acting and embodiment and so on. But even, you know, sort of finding metaphors in lots of things in life, the rock climbing. And so it actually makes something from your paper really make sense to me, you know, listening to your story there, because, you know, you started the paper with a rather sort of heartfelt statement, really, about the suffering of people with, you know, complex needs and people who present challenges, really, for health providers and so on, but for whom there's a sort of a paucity of evidence-based treatment. And you were sort of, there's a quote there, you know, that many will be given a diagnosis of personality disorder, which is sometimes taken as a derogatory term associated with shame and untreatability. I just wondered if you wouldn't mind just maybe elaborate a little bit on all that. Just give us a sense of perhaps your motivations there, working with this group and what this all means to you.
Yes, so this is something that I feel really passionately about. I know when you were smiling as you were reading the title of the paper, it's a bit long. And in fact, I had quite a grapple with the editor of the book that because the book title is quite similar. Because for me, it feels really important that both are in there. Is that the term personality disorder, because that's what people recognise, but I absolutely don't subscribe to it. So actually, it's a term that we have to use because it's still in common kind of parlance. But the idea that someone's personality could be disordered really irks me. And I think that has personal resonances that I think I've already mentioned. But also it makes no sense because actually this group of people, their behavior is completely normal and adaptive and understandable. So I guess that's why I wanted to start the paper in that way, because if you take someone's behavior out of context, which sadly I think is still the ways in which we diagnose people with a personality disorder, sorry, I've got a bit distracted because my internet's being irritating. But yes, we diagnose people with a personality disorder based on their behavior. You know, in England, you know, women, I mean, this is a bit black and white, but women may present to services with patterns, really understandable patterns, survival strategies around hurting themselves, and we give them a diagnosis of borderline personality disorder, but without understanding that actually self-harm is tragically adaptive. And I think that was my motivation for starting the paper in that way, and for engaging this group of people that ordinarily don't get anywhere near psychotherapy services, because it wasn't that long ago that we would castigate these people, boot them out of services, and say they're not treatable, they're undeserving, they're manipulative, they're attention seeking. Whereas actually, if you look at this in an ev through an evolutionary lens, this is just adaptation to hostile early rearing environments. And I love Darcy Enarvez's work. I definitely recommend people listen or read her Evolved Nest. And she said there's a beautiful book called Kinship. That she's also written. And she talks about, you know, where there isn't an evolved nest, where there isn't a place where children can feel a sense of safeness and connectedness, just very, very simply being held in the gaze of another whose motivation towards you is helpful, not harmful. Where that doesn't exist, then we have to adapt. And we've all adapted helpful, unhelpful strategies to as we've you know as we've gone through our own life patterns. We were talking about motorbikes just before. I'm just about to turn 50, which I'm very excited about, but I've also decided to take up the circus skills. My son calls it my midlife crisis class, which I think is hilarious, but he's probably got a bit of a point. Hanging upside down, often by my foot, with a bit of silk, with the instructor coming to lift me off the mat. But you know, we're all adapting. That's probably one of my ways of adapting to what it means to be 50 and what it means to be getting older. But yeah,
Yes.
take up sofa skills.
Yeah. Yes, I really loved turning 50. I finally didn't care what anyone else thought. Well, maybe a little bit. I still care a little bit, but yes, we're sort of adapting, and in a funny sort of a way, that's the well, it's both helps to sort of make sense of people and where they're at and some of their the difficulties they experience and even the behaviors that they exhibit or that sort of thing. It kind of makes sense, but it's also the optimism in a way of the approach that we continue to adapt, and if people are offered different experiences, then they maybe can adapt to that too, and sometimes in a positive direction.
That's, and I suppose that's what I see on so many different levels. And of course, you and I are, I'm sure, mutual admirers of Marcela Matos's work, and the work that she's been doing around epigenetic change. And I don't know, I think always by the time I ask Marcela about this, I'm always too many glasses of wine down, and I remember it's amazing, and then I can't quite get the details. But anyway, but I guess what I suppose what I see on a really that really stays with me is that, and I'm still finding a way, I'm still working out a way to ask people at the very beginning of therapy if I can take a photograph of them. I haven't worked out a way of saying that without having people having a really strong negative reaction to it, because people physically look different. I mean, I'm very fortunate, I'm in an incredibly fortunate position. My programs are 12 to 18 months, and we see people for over 3 years because we have a waiting list group, we have a moving on group. So I have a long period of time with people and they look different. They physically change. Now I'm sure that that is absolutely linked to epigenetic change, as well as lifestyle choices, sleep, connection. Actually, people look different when they come into group and they're met. There's so much fun stuff happens in the waiting room. I get a bit of FOMO because they all come into the waiting room and there's lots of bustle and chat, and they call it their pre-group. They'll come. Back in years ago, they all used to be outside smoking fags. Interestingly, there's less fag smoking these days, but they're a lot in the waiting room and they're doing something. They change. It's actually there is something transformative, and it does go beyond. It does feel like this is we're this is genetic level change. These people are different from when they start.
Well, there's kind of change in thoughts and feelings and behaviors. There's change in kind of or the ability to at least move about in the different motivations and that sort of thing. There's kind of the self-compassion means, health and well-being, doing things in the service of that and so on. You alluded to right at the early on, the spiritual changes really that kind of seem to happen. And then there's these epigenetic things that the research that I've listened to Marcella talk about that completely sober and still find it a little bit, just mind-blowing really in terms of the way that these, literally our genetic expression can change after compassionate mind training that she does or CFT. Your a key theme for you is what you I think you've really referring to as attachment and relational trauma. That seems to be your sort of how you kind of conveying the ideas around what might sometimes be referred to as personality disorders or changes in people's personality. And CFT offers kind of an approach to help with all that. So what's your sort of theory there with attachment and relational trauma?
So, as I think I said before, I find the diagnostic categories, they're stigmatizing, they're unhelpful, they're binary, they don't help. I mean, some people it does help them because it clusters things together in a way that means that they don't feel so mad. And I've certainly had lots of debates with people over the years where I remember with somebody in group where I think I'd probably got a little bit on my soapbox about, oh, we shouldn't be calling people disordered. And she turned around to me and said, so you're going to take away my diagnosis as well? As well as all my defensive. And I was like, okay, fair point. That was a really helpful learning point for me about, yeah, all right, kind of get off your soapbox, Kate. This is like psychotherapy, not your own personal crusade. But for me, attachment and relational trauma more accurately describes the experience of people who might attract that diagnosis, in that all of the people I've met over the last, what, 25 years of working I mean, actually, even before, if we go back to working with young kids and young people, but all of my career has been spent working with this group. And every single person I've met, from, my work in forensic with people that might be described as psychopathic or sociopathic, or all the way through working in secure services, working in community, working in charities, all the way that the whole spectrum of people that might sit in those nine diagnostic clusters, every single person that I have met has had significant ruptures, absences, intrusions in their attachment system, in that good stuff that Bowlby talks about, this proximity seeking, the being available to be met just on a very basic level with eye gaze. And if you think about, depressed mums aren't looking at their babies, it's not their fault. But those babies then aren't gazed on. So there's a whole array of adverse childhood experiences that we're talking about here, but that lead to, as I said, absences, ruptures, and also intrusions. And I've been really interested over the years in thinking about the lesser understood components of attachment trauma, that might be children that were given everything. And I think I see a lot of that around on a personal level. Where I live in Birmingham, there is huge affluence sitting right next to abject poverty. And those that have are not necessarily in a better place than those that haven't. And it's tragic. I see these kids that would appear to have everything, but actually they don't often have the thing that they need most, which is someone to say no. So, and I'm a parent, I'm not suggesting I've got this right, but I guess that's what I see. And I think that's a less understood impact, or it's perhaps less thought about attachment trauma. But also, I don't know, the word trauma also bothers me, because I worry that the word trauma is going to become the new disorder. Because as we sort of, m well, I don't know whether we're evolving or not. I don't think it's not clear at this stage, but I hear the word trauma talked co about constantly. Trauma, 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 trauma. It's my trauma. I'm triggered. I worry that we need to be really, really explicit about what it is that we're talking about. So although I couldn't put it in the paper because I think they drew the line at me talking about tragedy, because they're like, what are you talking about? For me, I prefer the word tragedy to trauma, and I try and weave it in wherever I can, because there's lots of definitions of trauma, which is about it's only trauma if you thought you were going to die. And that's just absolutely, for me, that's just absolutely not the case. Is that actually we're talking about tragic events, and something tragic might be you loved your granddad. And he died when you were seven, and nobody talked about it because everyone was grieving. That's a tragedy. I think about some of the life experiences of so many of my patients. Your mum was in hospital when you were a baby. Your mum died. There was poverty. There was crime. There was, these are tragic experiences. So I think, I don't know, kind of that. I suppose that's where I'm coming from with this. But seeing how significant the impact is on those attachment functions, proximity seeking, safe haven, secure base. And my hope is to create those overlapping attachment functions in the therapy group process externally in the beginning, to then hopefully develop a process that is internalized, and people can develop an internal proximity seeking to your compassionate other, to your compassionate self. Your own safe haven, your own sense of I can be there. I can be there for myself in a crisis, and a secure base, a place to be curious and explore the world from.
There's a lot of ways into it, I guess, that into the attachment and relational trauma. I mean that's something that really stands out in what you're saying, that there's many and varied versions really there, and in some ways tragedy does really ring more true as a word to kind of reference that. There's just so many possible ways that people can experience tragedy, and like you mentioned, the person who has everything but never has any boundaries or limits or guidance, that's tragic too, really, in a way, and can mean sort of this attachment and relational trauma, rupture, tragedy, or something like that. And a lot of that is in, I guess, the onset or the sort of the origins maybe of this presentation now. And although, would you say too that you often find that it's that there's ongoing trauma or tragedy for the person in their lives.
Yeah, and I know that this is talked, I know this has been talked about a lot in the trauma literature, but it's almost like you develop a valiancy, I think, for, and there's something written years ago, I remember when I was, so many, many years ago, about this idea about a stacking hypothesis. So thinking about actually how much these early tragic experiences hurt and interrupt the development or the flourishing of the brain on a very basic level, as well as, and of course that impacts on, I often find that I talk to one of my group members about this idea that cortisol petrol bombs the hippocampal functioning. Now, again, my brain science is not my thing, but I do understand that this idea that the kind of too much cortisol interrupts the hippocampal functioning. The hippocampus is a road and it's taking memories where they need to go. I know it's, I feel like, well, I've got quite a few friends who are neuroscientists and I can almost hear them going, that's not that thing. But anyway, you know what I mean?
Sounds good to me.
Yeah, well, it sounds good to me as well. And also, what most importantly, it sounds good to my group members because they're like, that's why I can't remember stuff. Yes, because you've got too much stress. And you think about what impact that is. So you're a kid at school. Your memory is it. You can't remember the name of the kid next to you. And you certainly can't remember the fact that your teacher set you homework last week. And you can see how it begins to stack. And actually, your capacity to regulate your old brain, your threat system, is really compromised. Because we need to be, we need eye gaze, we need touch, we need all of that somatic expressions of care and attachment. You know, we see it in our in mammals, don't we? Kind of the picking and the touching and the holding. But without that, then actually these kids are explosive or withdrawn. So you can see how it stacks up. So it is a developmental process that leads to. It makes my heart sad. And so often I see people for assessment and they have multiple children, many of whom have special needs of various different kinds. Now, again, I think a little bit has been written about this, but I see anecdotally most of my patients have multiple children. Most of those children have significant difficulties themselves. So my group members blame themselves because they look, I'm hurting my children, which on one level, let's be really clear about this. Yes, that is true. It's, you know, let's not shy away from this. You know, compassion is about turning back to, yes, you are hurting your children when you lock yourself in your room for a days on end and they have to fend for themselves. But it's tragic. It links to this marvelous chap called Martin Brun, who's written a fantastic paper that if people are interested in this, they should read. It's called Too Fast, Why Fast, Why Furious. He talks about this idea, this kind of live fast, die young. Women with, they did a study in women with a diagnosis of borderline personality disorder were reaching the age of sexual maturity five times earlier than their counterparts who didn't have that diagnosis. So they're reaching sexual maturity earlier. And as we understand, once you reach sexual maturity, then of course along comes the desire to act on that capacity. So many of my patients, and I'm not saying if you have kids young, that means you've got to, but you know, they do go hand in hand. So then they're having kids young themselves. You can see that the relationship trauma, Freud said, what we don't resolve, we repeat. Early relationship trauma gets repeated in their adolescent and then adult relationships. Domestic violence and abuse, controlling, coercive relationships are some of the many threads. And my group members are not just the folk that have been subjugated by these experiences. They're also the perpetrators. We have group members who have been the perpetrators of controlling, coercive, violent behaviour, as well as people that have been subject to it. And that's controversial. Some people think that we should never do that, but I think you've got to live in a world with human beings in it. And you're going to sit next to people on the bus who are, you know, kind of who might not be the kind of people you want to spend time with. I agree, it's a gradual developmental. And then, of course, it feels like the Velcro for the people that might hurt them. And there's a tragic comfort in that.
Yes, it really does sort of stack across time. And I was thinking the epigenetic change is kind of almost irrelevant there too, but at the other end, when you know, in the early days and changes start to happen and sort of the traumas and tragedies kind of stack and then gradually persist into adulthood for the person as well as they kind of have various experiences and then potentially passed on to to their own kids maybe
Yeah.
sometimes, and you
Yeah.
can sort of see this kind of stacking even across the generations. It really does sort of move us, doesn't it, to imagine, that kind of life and what that must all be like. You propose a sort of a five phase model of compassion focused group psychotherapy, and so yeah, and particularly when treating this group and kind of keeping one eye on the attachment and relational trauma stuff and so on. So yeah, give us a sense of your approach there once people are in the group.
So I think it's I think the thing for me is long and slow. And I fully appreciate that for many people in their service provision, that's not possible. But someone asked me when I was still having my viva for my PhD, the external examiner said, if you could sum up the whole thing, what would your message be to service providers? And I said, don't be cheap. That's the message. Don't be cheap, because not only is it not, it's counterproductive from a cost point of view. If you give people, these folk, lots of short-term therapies, they'll just come back. And each time they come back, they're more aggrieved, they're more re-traumatized. So you're wasting your time and everybody's money. So for me, the five phases is to really slow things down. And phase one, assessment and formulation. See people for a few times. Spend some time. And as I said, this is very current because I'm writing a six chapter or seven chapter book. So one chapter for each phase and then an introduction and a conclusion. So that will be out. The deadline is August, as long as I don't collapse beforehand, because I'm finding it quite challenging. I've been reached out to your friend of mine, James Kirby and Nikki, going, how do you write a book?
Yes.
Actually, they've given me some helpful advice. But so the assessment and formulation phase, slow it down, take some time, see, on a very basic level, walk through your waiting room. What's it like? Write letters to people, not about them. So really kind of beginning, starting that attachment relationship right at the very beginning. If it can't be said in 2 pages, don't say it. Who would want to read it? Who would want to receive a 7-page letter about them through the post? I mean, I wouldn't. So why would I do that to my patients? Again, that kind of a slow unfolding process. Start the formulation, but don't be pulling out diagrams in the second session, because they're not going to make any sense to people. It might just inform what you do rather than it doesn't have formulation for me as a process that takes us all the way through the therapeutic, the time in therapy. Paul's written a fantastic, there's some fantastic work in the new book, in the compassion-focused therapy textbook that people may have seen. I'm looking at it because it's up on my shelf there. He writes fantastic stuff about formulation. It's got to first and foremost be de-shaming. So that's the kind of that's the foundation that we're then building the therapeutic process on. And because we all work in services that have long waiting lists, we have a waiting list group. It's called the Tea and Biscuits group, although don't tell the commissioners. But we bring people together. We make them a cup of tea. We give them a biscuit. We there's an opportunity to ask about the group, but on a very basic level, it's an opportunity to sit in a room to feel what it's like to be in a group before the therapy starts. And that group is run with a lived experience practitioner, which is someone who graduated. We have people that have graduated from our program that now work with us. It's really exciting in our NHS Trust in Birmingham. We are not, I wouldn't say that we're at the front of the game, but we're doing pretty well. We have two people who are band six, which is a senior, that's a senior role. That's a decently paid role, who are people with lived experience. And Sarah works with me. She graduated from the program about 6 years ago, and so she and I run the waiting list group and the moving on group at the end together. And I sit back, I go and make the tea, and because people are far more interested in what Sarah has to say than I have, because I'm a therapist. Of course, I'm going to say it's great. So that group, people can come once a month for as long as they're waiting, and that group will be there every month. If you don't come, you won't get discharged. We won't write you a letter and say, why didn't you come? It's an offer, it's an invitation, and it has no impact on people's waiting time. It's an offer. And it's what my hope is, and this is what people have said to me over the years, is that it gives them an experience of being held in mind. That absent eye gaze, even if you don't come, you're in my mind. I know we haven't started yet, and I know it's a long wait, but you're there. phase three, preparation and engagement. We've separated the preparation and engagement from the exploratory, because otherwise you just do 12, 18 months of of psychoeducation. So you do the psychoeducation, it's slow paced, there's games, there's we don't have huge expectations of people. They can come and just sit in a chair outside the circle in the escape pod. So they don't have to engage if they're not able to. We make images of our inner critics. We throw scarves, we swoosh scarves around. We have a garden next to our therapy room in one of the dodgiest areas of Birmingham. But anyway, sometimes you find things. One time, it wasn't in my group, one time two people that were escaping from the police jumped the fence into the garden, talking about cultivating the space for safeness. And then the police tasered them and attacked them on the lawn. But anyway, that doesn't happen very often. But so that preparation and engagement phase, people go all the way around, but it's a rolling program. So you might start at a different point, but everybody does 12 weeks, and then you move on to the exploratory group. And that's where we get much more of the kind of psychodrama, chair work, reworking early trauma, letter writing, working using symbols. And then they finish. And then the moving on group, people will come very similar to the waiting list group for an hour a month. We said up to 12 months, but people have just kind of stayed, and we haven't had a point where people have stayed for more than 12 months. So what happens is people decide that they don't need to come anymore, which feels like a really lovely way to, not lovely, what's the word I'm looking for? It feels like it's a real nod to the attachment system. When you're ready to individuate, then, and people move on from the moving on group. And that's Sarah and I, more tea and biscuits.
Mm.
That's a bit of a potted. I'm aware of time and food. I could keep going on about this.
Yeah.
I'm
well,
a
it
bit
is
embedded in it. But...
It's beautifully described in your paper as well. And there's a very useful table there that really kind of outlines the five phases. And yes, you can sort of feel the attachment stuff weaving through it. You know, the cultivation of the proximity, the secure base, the safe haven, you know, it's all in there, and people sort of gradually, slowly move through it. There's some real sort of more kind of like skills training in the third sort of phase, and then there's more, you know, lots of, by the sounds of it, great work in the fourth phase using some of the compassion-focused therapy strategies and activities and different things. But then people can sort of stay, and moving on, you know, kind of takes time as well. You kind of I guess evaluated all of that then in the paper itself and the study. I was going to ask you just a briefly about methodology, I guess, like what were the basics there of the study, but then what did you find?
Well, the original study, we had we tried to have a control group of sorts. But what we found was, so we had a group of people that we just gave 12 weeks to, which is a separate study, which I'm now going to publish separately. But what we found, well, what I found about 2 weeks before I handed in my PhD, was that they were significantly different. So actually, I was like, I'm not sure how much I could really say about these two groups in terms of their differential experience of one had 12 weeks, one had 12 months. So the methodology that's presented in the paper is slightly different from what I originally put together, because I wanted to be able to demonstrate the differential experience of longer versus shorter term therapy, which I did, but that there was a significant difference when I did a chi-square test at the end. There was a significant difference in the diagnostic categories. So I feel like actually that's a study on its own, in terms of there were more people in that group with a primary diagnosis of bipolar or schizoaffective. So actually, but they did have a particularly unique response. They did really well in the first 12 weeks and then took a massive dive. I would think that when you're giving any people, not enough therapy, a shorter duration, I think that those results would probably be replicated. So the methodology that I've presented in the paper is that these people that were recruited from, I work in an outpatient psychotherapy service. It was a naturalistic study. So that's, you know, that there's always limitations of that. But I think it's really hard to do things like randomized controlled trials when the therapy is 12 months, because treatment as usual for 12 months feels, well, certainly for this group of people, feels really unethical. But these people went through the program. We had I haven't even, the data that you see in the paper isn't even all of the data set. I couldn't get it all in. But we had various evaluation points throughout the therapy, and then we followed them up after 12 months. And the exciting headline from that is we've also just finished a 7-year follow-up study. So we followed them up again, for some of them 7 years after they finished therapy. And that paper will be coming out probably towards the end of this year, because we an amazing Deakin site student, psychology, who flew through her viva because she did an incredible project. We contacted everybody again, and 7 people agreed to be interviewed. And she's done an IPA, an interpretive phonological analysis, on that data. So that's coming as well. But the data were both similar in terms of what we found. But people, headlines was that the changes across all of the measures, process, symptoms, were significant and maintained at 12 months follow-up. And we threw my PhD supervisor was an incredible, is an incredible statistician. We threw the kitchen sink at this analysis-wise. So we did an intention to treat. We gave the people that dropped out the worst 10% of scores from the study. We looked at reliable change. So we got all the scores and put them together and then saw what they looked like. And we didn't have that kind of outliers, dragging all the data in one particular direction. So I suppose on a very basic level, there were significant changes and they were maintained. And the qualitative data, which is coming, as I said, soon, that absolutely supported that. This changed things. And safeness was the key construct, key theme, overarching theme from the whole study. The conditions for safeness, not safety, safeness. Where there is no threat. That was absolutely universally the thing that people described, was that because the program was long and slow, and we paid a lot of attention to particular details and gave people an opportunity to restart, then what happened was that those conditions for safeness were cultivated from the first moment of contact to the last moment of contact. And that's the thing that people said made the difference.
The four time points, I think, weren't there? Start, end of program engagement group, then through to end of program, and then through to 12-month follow-up. When does the first phase begin in amongst that?
The baseline data is gathered at phase one, at the
Right,
beginning.
and at intake
So
sort of
then you've
thing.
got that tau period. You've got that baseline measure from the beginning, from the first contact to the start of therapy. So
Yes,
you can
great.
see whether or not that, so that we can say more decisively that the intervention is what has created the change,
Yeah.
rather than just getting better on their own, if that makes
And
sense.
that was my next kind of question was, yes, from end of PEG to end of program, that's where the bulk of the
That's the
change
therapy.
occurred, across all of the
Yeah.
different variables. I'm looking at some lovely figures that I might even put up on the screen on the YouTube video, but yeah, that's really showing fears of compassion across the three flows really reducing very significantly, and then kind of being maintained at follow up, and forms of self-reassuring and self-attacking scale, that the self criticism reduced and the self-reassurance sort of increased, but there were lots of other
Yeah,
kind of measures as
those
well.
are my favorite measures. I think they're the
Yeah.
ones that speak most to CFT.
And I always love a good colorful figure, so that was handy for me as well. Did you get a sense that earlier on you were talking about how we might create a kind of a safeness and a security around the person that then shifts to something more internalized, I guess. I mean, is that what you were saying before about safeness, or what would you say for this group in terms of that internalized sense of safeness and security?
It's interesting because I think it slowly develops through the program. So in the early 12 weeks, in that preparation and engagement phase, the way I think about it is that we're dropping pebbles. So we're introducing ideas. I wouldn't expect everyone to finish the 12 weeks and have a compassionate other and really truly understand what compassion meant, and to have a kit bag full of multi-sensory ways that they can develop their compassionate identity. I wouldn't expect that. We're dropping pebbles and hoping that something ripples. And also giving them, I mean, Yalom talks beautifully, doesn't he, about group cohesion and groupishness, that we're really trying to create those conditions for a group. And I suppose coming back to, for me, all of our ancestral history is very much an important part for me of the psychotherapy process, is that we're on a very basic level. We're sitting around the fire and we're telling stories. We're telling stories to make sense of our experience. So that is a lot more in the early phases. And still people will, in those early stages, not necessarily feel the sense of safeness in the room. We've set up the program so that the expectation is that everybody will speak, because we pass it around the circle so that there is a very strong element of turn-taking, that we have a check-in and everybody passes it round. That is designed to replicate something from our ancestral history, but also about helping people to learn the social skills, to share the space, to take the space. But that second phase is much more, I think, about how do we help the group to begin to. So I think about the vertical and the horizontal transference. And in those early stages, the transference is very vertical. They sit looking at myself and my co-facilitator, waiting, waiting for us to lead everything. Whereas as we move into that second phase, the idea is that we're really trying to flatten that hierarchy and bring that transference into much more of a sibling, a horizontal transference, where the group will help each other. And the check-in is and the check-in and the feedback becomes much more self-directed. They get that if they take too much time in their check-in, there's less time to do the work, as they call it. And actually, interestingly, these guys can't wait to get the scarves out. They can't wait to get the chairs out. And that's when you know that there is a sense of safeness in the room. And then, of course, as people move through the work, that idea, as you say, that the idea is that the safeness through the compassionate mind training, through the strategies and the ways that we work, that will be internalized. We were doing some calm place imagery making, image making. And one of our group members drew the group room with everybody in it and a hot, like 100 cats. And I was like, I'm glad that's an image that stays in your mind. So that idea that this was internalized, she took the group with her. It's always a lovely thing. It always makes me smile and brings a tear to my eye when people say, someone was talking about the other day, she was on a train platform and some guy she was talking on the phone and she swore. And some guy came up to her and just started shouting in her face, saying, it's disgusting, girls of your, anyway, just being abhorrent. And she said, I imagined that you were all around me. And then I imagined what you would say. And she channeled one of the group members who's quite a lot more feisty. And she told him to piss off. But it was just that, because for me, that's a lovely example of when that process has been internalized.
Yes.
So they've internalized the group and the safeness that comes with it, to then go and use the group as a secure base to explore developing their own compassionate identity, assertiveness,
yes,
courage, strength, wisdom.
Beautiful. It's all in there. A really specific question prompted in me. What's your thought about calm place imagery versus safe place imagery? Do you have a view there, given that you're working towards safeness, but you were sort of mentioning calm place imagery? It's just a little question, but what are your thoughts there?
I never use the word safe.
Okay.
I don't ever use it, because my experience is that my group members don't know what it means. I also think it can put pressure on them to do something that they can't do. So I've been guided by them. So we have calm place imagery, welcoming place. And one of the things that one of my group members has coined is a place of belonging. So, and I'll give you a lovely example of this about how we move from safety to safeness. So one of our group members in the early days, her place of belonging or her welcoming place was under her dad's desk in his office, which is where she used to hide as a child. Now, my kind of, therapist head is going, oh, that doesn't really sound very good. I don't really want you to be there. But you know what? That was a place of safety, because actually all she could do in the early stages was find a place of safety. So her threat system's on, the lion's coming, but there is at least a table. So she taught me a lot about actually letting this process unfold, because I really grappled with it. And I was like, oh, I mean, I didn't do this in group, but in my own head, I was like, oh, that's not right. And about 3 months later, she spontaneously came back to group and said, I've got a new calm place. And we were like, great, tell us about it. And she said, yeah, it's a library and it's full of books and it's got one of them little wheelie ladders that goes up and down. And she said, there's loads of light in it and there's a garden outside and it's peaceful and I can hear the birds singing. And I was just like, winner. That is a space of safeness. Now, I didn't need to ex be explicit with her because she already got it. She said I was hiding underneath my dad's table because that was the only, that's all I could do. But I don't need his table anymore because I've got my library. So to me, that's the work. But the idea of a safe place, what you'll get is cupboards, wardrobes under the bed, because that's where people hid. So it's shifting it. Where let's create a place where you belong. Let's create a place that has a mind and that mind welcomes you. So a lot of the part of my compassionate image, the compassionate or calm place imagery uses imagine this place has a mind and this mind welcomes you. If people are interested, it's on a SoundCloud on the internet that people can access. But it's just that idea of being welcomed into this place and belonging in this place.
Well, it's amazing, Kate. Thank you so much. The concluding remarks there really sort of, the first thing I think to go back to is that idea of this alternative way, I guess, of describing patients diagnosed with personality disorders as this attachment and relational trauma or tragedy or that sort of thing. And it's a little sort of paradigm shift a little bit, or a concept shift or something like that, but it feels like it's very helpful there. And then the results really of the group sort of speak for themselves, that it's particularly effective even for this group that kind of is difficult. They can find it difficult to kind of make changes in their lives. You've got a lot of projects on the go. You've got some more research coming. I know you do a lot of training and supervision and things like that. Is there anything there that you'd like to share in terms of what's coming up for you, or how people could engage with you, perhaps even?
I mean, I suppose what we've got now is I suppose we've got I think about little CFGP babies. So in the UK, we've got three or four CFGP babies. So we've got the program project in Birmingham, and then what we've done now is that there's a number of people in different places and different psychotherapy services developing CFGP. Using this model in their own services. So I suppose it's just that, and that's in there's some in Secure in community services. So people are interested, then kind of look up the research. And certainly a lot of people contact me about how do I get this set up. And the book will be coming at some point. And if you do want to invite me to Australia, Stan, you know that it's a place that's very close to my heart. So have a chat with James.
Yes. What a good idea. What a good idea. When your book comes out, that could be the trigger point. But that's great. I'll actually put a few of those links that you've mentioned. You've mentioned a couple of other papers and also your own work. I'll put all the links there. Maybe the Spotify or SoundCloud thing
SoundCloud,
that you
yeah, and
mentioned as
there's of course
well.
the book chapter in the big book and the compassionate kit bag paper, which are kind of I guess is the bits that sit around the edge of that.
Yes, good. We'll provide those links as well. But thank you very much, Kate, for coming and talking with me on Compassion in a T-shirt.
And thank you, Stan. And just to say, this work is fantastic. So keep going and keep riding your motorbike, keep riding your Enfield.
Thank you.